Good evening, everybody. So let's start by generating our motivation. And really have a big mind considering the situation of all sentient beings right now. And how they're born again and again in cyclic existence, due to the ignorance that grasps at true or inherent existence. And through that ignorance they create karma, which is implanted on the consciousness, which is fertilized at the time of death, and the karma is fertilized, the mind grasps for another body and gets it, and then there we are with birth, aging, sickness, and death once again. So this is our situation and the situation of each and every living being. And though we feel kind of permanent and secure, we certainly aren't. Any small condition can change, and we'll be in our next life very quickly. So while we have this opportunity to learn and practice the Dharma, let's really take it and make good use of it. And remembering that all other beings are like us in being trapped in this cycle of existence through the power of ignorance, afflictions, and karma. Then let's develop compassion for all of us, ourselves and others, and seek to actualize our full spiritual potential, traversing the Bodhisattva grounds and paths to full Buddhahood, so that we'll have some sensitivity and wisdom regarding how to guide others, how to help others, which would be very nice, because then we could actually do something worthwhile. Let's generate that intention and listen to the teachings tonight so that we can attain that full awakening. So we can look at our situation right now, and, you know, we may see sentient beings being miserable, and, you know, some compassion may arise and want to help, but then we don't know what to do. Or we think we know what to do, but then it doesn't work. We get the exact opposite and, you know, result in what we thought. So, and sometimes we don't even have much compassion wanting to help. We are too involved with ourselves and just thinking about what's going to make me happy and how I can be famous and well known and respected. Yeah? So, you know, to have all those conditions of compassion plus wisdom plus skill and ability come together, it takes some work. Mm-hmm. So that's why we need to learn how to do it and then practice doing it, both of those things together. Okay. So I know there's a few new people here this evening. If you don't understand much, that's okay. Where you're coming in towards the end of a teaching on the paths and grounds of here solitary realizers and bodhisattvas, how they progress on their paths to their own respective enlightenments. So just listen, take in what you can, and then one day you'll hear the teaching from the beginning and more understanding will come. Okay, so last week I had, we were talking about the first ground, the first bhumi of the bodhisattvas, and we came across this part that was saying, that the, you know, we have the 16 moments of knowledge and forbearance, remember? Yeah. That eliminate the three fetters, you know, together with their seeds. And so those three fetters were the view of the personal identity, the view holding bad ethics and conduct as supreme, and then deluded doubt. Okay. And then there was this question, well, that doesn't sound like it's usually described, because they usually say that the path of seeing eliminates the acquired afflictions. And also, according to the Prasangika, which this text is, the view of the personal identity and all the other afflictions aren't completely abandoned until the very first part of the eighth bhumi. So what is this saying, you know? And then I was saying that, you know, when we talk about the hearer's path, that those three fetters are described, you know, in the Pali Canon as being eliminated on the by stream enterers, which is the path of seeing. But I found the answer for how the Prasangikas explain this, okay? So why these three? So according to Nagarjuna's Precious Garland, he explains that the seeds of the afflictions aren't eliminated until the first part of the eighth bhumi. Okay. So the grasping at true existence is not eliminated until then either. And so since the view of the personal identity, or jitta in Tibetan, is considered a form of self-grasping, it also isn't fully eliminated until then, the beginning part of the eighth bhumi. So when the text is talking here and saying about the view of the personal identity, the deluded doubt and the wrong view that holds wrong ethics and wrong conduct as supreme, it's talking there about the those afflictions as described in the two knowledges, okay? When they talk about the two knowledges, they're referring to the treasury of knowledge and the compendium of knowledge. Mm-hmm. So the treasury of knowledge is by Vasubandhu, and the compendium of knowledge is by?
What's his name?
No. Sangha. Okay. So in both of those, according to both of those tenets, you know, systems that are expressed in those, the two knowledges, the grasping that you have to eliminate to attain liberation is the grasping at a self-sufficient, substantial, existent person. And the afflictions that are eliminated are those which are based on grasping a self-sufficient, substantially existent person. Okay? Because remember that Vipassika, Satantrika, Chittamadra, you know, even the Satantrikas, Svatantrikas, are saying that things do inherently exist, and that, you know, to attain liberation, you only have to eliminate the grasping at the self-sufficient, substantially existent person, not even any kind of grasping at phenomena. Okay? So the afflictions described in the two knowledges are those which are based on, you know, the ignorance and the view of the personal identity that grasp at self-sufficient, substantial, existent person. So those are the ones that are eliminated on the first bhumi. That's what this passage is referring to. So not the view of the personal aggregates, the deluded doubt, the wrong view about ethics, that is based on grasping at true existence. Okay? It's not that difficult.
No, it's just subtle.
Yeah, it's not that difficult. It's that the tenet systems have two different versions of what you have to eliminate in order to attain liberation. And the Prasangika is much more subtle because they're the only ones that say grasping inherent existence is an afflictive obscuration. Okay? And so there's a difference between the afflictions that are based on grasping a self-sufficient, substantially existent person and the afflictions based on grasping an inherently existent person. They're different because there's different kinds of graspings that are underneath them. And you can eliminate the grasping at a self-sufficient, substantially existent person and all the afflictions that it supports and still have the grasping at inherent existence and all the afflictions it supports. So in the first bhumi here, where it's talking about those three being eliminated, it's talking about the coarse form that's supported by the grasping at self-sufficient, substantially existent person. Okay, so that doesn't contradict, when we're saying that the acquired afflictions are eliminated. Mm. Yeah?
Do they use the same word for, when they use the word jivta,
mm-hmm.
does one of them refer to this SSSE and the other refer to true existence?
Right.
So they're using the same
word. Right, they're using the same word, view of personal identity, but they're defining it differently.
Mm-hmm.
They're using the same word ignorance, but defining it differently.
Mm-hmm. According to their system.
Right.
So if we were just reading those texts,
uh-huh.
it would look exactly like, you would have to have this more subtle understanding of
yeah.
what these things are.
Right, that's why we study the tenet systems,
yeah.
so that when we know, when we read different texts, what they're actually talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Because they'll often use the same words, but define them very differently. Okay. And that's where you really see the difference in the tenet systems and how you identify the object of negation, makes such a huge difference between the different systems. Because it influences, what they say are afflictive obscurations, what they say are cognitive obscurations, what they say you abandon, on the path of seeing and eighth bhumi, it influences so many different things. Okay? So, yeah. So anyway, that clears up that qualm. Okay. Then we were still talking about the first ground. So we were looking at Nagarjuna's precious garland in the quote, where he said, the first of these, so the first ground, is the very joyful, since the bodhisattva is rejoicing. Bodhisattva is very happy. He or she forsakes those three fetters, okay, so the coarse forms of those three fetters, and is born into the lineage of the Tathagatas. So that first ground, the first grounder, is said to be surpasses the hearers and solitary realizers in terms of their lineage at that point. Because now they have the direct realization of emptiness, plus they have the bodhicitta, which the disciples don't have. Okay? So when they say that it surpasses them in terms of lineage, it's kind of, they use the example of, you have Queen Elizabeth, and then you have Prince Charles, okay? So Prince Charles isn't king, but he's going to be king. Okay, because of the family he's born into. Whereas, me, I'm not going to be the king of England. I wasn't born into that family. So in that way, the first ground bodhisattvas are really born into the family of the Buddhas because now they have the direct realization of emptiness based on bodhicitta, so they eventually will become fully enlightened Buddhists. Whereas the hearers, you know, are from a quote-unquote inferior lineage in that they don't have that bodhicitta, and so they don't have it sustaining the wisdom. Okay? And then Nagarjuna continues, through the maturation of these qualities, the perfection of giving becomes supreme. Okay, so the first of the far-reaching practices becomes supreme, meaning that they reach a really refined state of generosity. Of course, their generosity is going to continue to improve as they continue on the higher bhumis, but at least at this point, you know, it's really substantially different than it was before. The bodhisattvas vibrate 100 worlds and become a great lord of the world. So when it talks about vibrating 100 worlds, it's referring to those 12 qualities, remember? Like seeing 100 Buddhas and vibrating 100 worlds and going to 100 pure lands and so on. So they have those, the 100 of each of those 12 sets of qualities. Okay, and they can be born as a great lord of the world, which is one way in which they benefit sentient beings. So the lord of the world is referring to a Chakravarti king that is a wheel-turning king, that is king over our earth. Okay, so you'll see that there's different kinds of Chakravarti kings, but the one over our earth. That's according to ancient Indian mythology. Okay? So, then, the text says, there is reason for calling this ground the very joyful, because seeing that through the power of amassing the accumulations in subsequent attainment, in dependence upon directly realizing emptiness and meditative equipoise, one has a special ability to further the welfare of sentient beings and to achieve an omniscient consciousness. So because of all that, one attains marvelous mental joy. That's one sentence in a paragraph. Okay, so the reason it's called very joyful is because that bodhisattva can, you know, they have the power of amassing so much accumulation of merit during the time subsequent to their meditative equipoise on emptiness, when they're, you know, doing activities motivated by compassion and bodhicitta. But their activities motivated by compassion and bodhicitta are done in dependence upon the wisdom that directly realizes emptiness. So that it's different. You know, the merit they create is different because they have that direct realization. Although at the time of doing their practices of generosity, they're not directly realizing emptiness. But their practice is influenced by their previous meditative equipoise on emptiness. Okay, so because of that, they have a special welfare, a special capacity to further the welfare of sentient beings, and a special capacity to achieve an omniscient consciousness. Okay, so they have this ability now that they didn't have before the first bhumi. And so because they have this ability, then they have this marvelous joy. So it's called the very joyful. Okay. Then Maitreya's ornament for the Mahayana Sutras, a text called Mahayana Sutra Alankara, says, seeing that one is close to enlightenment and can achieve the purposes of sentient beings, one generates great joy. Therefore, it is called the very joyful. He said it so succinctly. Isn't that sweet? One's close to enlightenment because of having the way method and wisdom are combined. So you can achieve the purposes of sentient beings, okay? Which means, you know, after you attain enlightenment, you can have the form bodies because they fulfill the purposes of sentient beings. So knowing that you can attain that, then you have great joy. So that bhumi is called the very joyful. So think about that, you know. Imagine being a first bhumi bodhisattva and having this incredible confidence that you can become a Buddha because you have, you know, the bodhicitta, spontaneous, and the direct realization of emptiness. So it's just going to be a matter of time now, and you're not going to backslide. Yeah. So you're really, really happy about that, because your whole purpose, the whole thing you want in life, is to be of the greatest benefit to others. So now it's becoming clear that you'll be able to attain your goal. So you're really, really happy. Then think about what sentient beings get really, really happy about.
Chocolate cake.
Yeah.
iPhones.
The Red Sox. You know? So here you see the difference between an ordinary being and a bodhisattva. You know, what is it that makes us happy, and what makes a bodhisattva happy? And then we see, you know, what we need to abandon and what we need to cultivate. Yeah?
So at this point, they still have the seeds of affliction.
Right.
But when things ripen that are negative, do they have the skill to immediately sort of cut it?
Okay. So they still have the seeds of the afflictions, but when, let's say, some kind of manifest or bad circumstances happen to them, do they get upset and so on? They may get a little bit upset, but right away they see the uselessness of that, and they also see the emptiness of the situation.
Yeah. So depression and discouragement are basically gone.
Yeah, you're not going to, I don't think you're going to have a depressed bodhisattva and a discouraged bodhisattva. I don't think a first ground bodhisattva goes, oh, all those other bodhisattvas, second, third, fourth, up to tenth, they're so much better than I am. Oh, you know, they have get so many more offerings than I do. They're so much more famous. I'm just a first boomy bodhisattva, so lowly. Oh, what am I going to do? You know, this is just hopeless. I don't think they have that problem.
That's good news.
Yeah. It is, isn't it? Yeah. Because I think, you know, even before that ground, I think if, you know, when you're really sincerely practicing, you know, then you don't get depressed. Yeah, because, I mean, what is depression? Depression is a form of laziness. Sit with that one for a while. It's the laziness of discouragement. It's a form of, you know, it's a kind of affliction. Yeah. So when you're really practicing, then if an affliction arises in your mind, you know it for what it is. And you say, oh, you know, discouragement, depression, that's the laziness of, you know, a type of laziness. It's an afflicted mental state. It's not seeing reality correctly. I'm not going to nourish that mind. Yeah. And so you bring yourself out of it. Okay? Because, you know, why? But you're going to say, oh, but the discouraged mind is realistic. Is it really? Are you that bad? You know, what your discouraged mind makes up that you are, is that true? Is that reality? It is not, is it? It's totally, you know, whacked out. Inappropriate intention, exaggerated mind, isn't it? Yeah? So, you know, you catch it when it arises. And you know it for what it is, and you don't follow it. Yeah? Because as soon as you start following that depressed mind, it's like the thief knocked at your door, you opened the door, you said, oh, please come in. Sit down, have a cup of tea, you know? Some brownies, hang around for a while. That's what you're saying to the thief when you let that discouraged mind take you over. Yeah?
It's just a familiar thief. We've had brownies together. Yeah,
right. Okay.
Sorry.
Okay. So it's a very familiar thief. You grew up next door to him. Yeah, you ate brownies together daily. Yeah, You know him well. He knows you well. You feel a little bit guilty for kicking him out because you know him so well and it might be rude. Yeah. So you welcome the thief in and you sit down and get depressed. Right?
Right.
Yeah. And then you come to me and say, I'm depressed. And I might just say, you're lazy. And then you get mad. How dare you say I'm lazy? Yeah. Yeah, the depression's younger brother, his anger, has just come in our house. What?
His twin.
Yeah. You know? So then you have multiple thieves in your house. You say, I am not lazy. It is really this awful. I'm so bad. Yeah? As if you want me to fix it. What am I supposed to do? You know, when we get depressed, we want somebody else to fix it, don't we?
Calculable children, hurry up.
Yeah. So what am I supposed to do? Oh, you're so wonderful, you're so intelligent, you're the best disciple around, you're so good, you're this, you're that, you're this, you're that. Is that what you want to hear? So you want a lot of praise. but you, do you believe it?
No.
Yeah. So you want somebody to praise you, but when they praise you, you don't believe it.
No,
you
think they're crazy.
Yeah, you think they're crazy, because you're really not that good. Yeah. But say it some more anyway, even though it's not true. Yeah. Okay. So do you see why they're called afflicted mental states? Yeah, there's a reason for it. Okay. So also, Nagarjuna's praise to the element of qualities says, since one has thoroughly abandoned unwholesome bases and taken up well the wholesome bases, at this time that definite realizer is called the joyful. So this mind also knows how to discriminate what's wholesome, virtuous, and what isn't. And it knows that very clearly. So it's also joyful. That mind doesn't get all confused. Should I do this? Should I not do that? You know, what are people going to say about me? Okay, now we're on the second ground. Yeah. So the explanation of the second ground, the stainless, has four parts. So it's the same four parts. First one, the mode of achieving qualities in the second ground. So on this ground, one attains 1,000 sets of the 12 good qualities explained previously. Okay, so you're upped by ten times, okay? So you see 1,000 Buddhas, go to 1,000 pure lands, make 1,000 emanations, and so forth. And then the second quality, the mode of achieving majesty of power on the second ground. On the occasion of the exalted wisdom of subsequent attainment, one amasses the collection of merit for the sake of abandoning the middling of the great afflictions, which are the objects of abandonment by a path of meditation. Yeah. So having seen the signs of the ability to do this, one sets in equipoise on emptiness. Okay, so you see that you're able to abandon the middling of the great afflictions. So then you move from that meditative equipoise, which is neither, into the meditative equipoise that is an uninterrupted path. That becomes an actual antidote to the middling of the great afflictions, which are the objects of abandonment by a path of meditation. And by that, one's able to progress to the third ground. Okay? So when you're on the first ground, Yeah, you see that you're, if we backstep to the first ground, you see that your meditation on emptiness is getting more and more potent, and you'll soon be able to abandon the great of the great innate afflictions. Mm-hmm. So then you go into meditative equipoise, which is an uninterrupted path, which is when you have eliminated, or you are eliminating it, and then you, from the uninterrupted path, you pass to a liberated path. Yeah, this is on the second bhumi now, where that the great of the great afflictions has been eliminated. So then similarly, when you're on the second bhumi, you're practicing and creating merit and still meditating on emptiness and everything else. And then at a certain point in your meditation on emptiness, you see that it'll soon be powerful enough to eliminate the middling of the great afflictions. So then you pass into the uninterrupted path, and then the liberated path, which take you into, which are the third bhumi. Okay? So then the third one, we're still on the second ground here, is the mode of surpassing practice, of a far-reaching practice on the second ground. So on this ground, through the force of the wisdom directly realizing the three spheres as empty of true existence, the three ethics of a bodhisattva are guarded by way of destroying the opportunity for the generation of the stains of faulty ethics at the time of either waking or dreams. Okay. So when you're on the second ground, by the force of your wisdom realizing the emptiness of the three spheres, agent, object, and action, okay, then by the force of seeing that emptiness, the way you protect your ethical conduct becomes really surpassing. So that bodhisattva, that they're surpassing far-reaching practice as ethical conduct, and so there's the three ethical conducts of a bodhisattva, which are, first one?
Refraining from harm.
Refraining from negativities, which entails keeping precepts. Second one?
Cultivating virtue.
Cultivating, doing virtuous actions. Third one?
Benefiting
sentient beings. Okay? So your three types of ethical conduct become really superior or surpassing because of how your wisdom realizing emptiness can see the emptiness of the three spheres, and so see ethical conduct as like as an illusion. And so through that bodhisattva destroys the opportunity for transgressing their ethical, any of those three kinds of ethical conduct, not only when they're awake, but also when they're sleeping. So that's pretty good, isn't it? I mean, we have a hard time keeping good ethical conduct when we're awake. But, so you get to the point where you can keep really, really good ethical conduct when you're awake because your mindfulness is, clear, your introspective awareness is clear, you know what to practice and what to abandon, you have some wisdom, you're not confused about that. So in your waking state, you're very clear. How about dreams? Our mind is usually pretty uncontrolled in dreams. All sorts of stuff. Yeah. We do all sorts of things in dreams that we certainly wouldn't do in a waking state. So it's much harder to abandon even the thought, let alone the dream action, unwholesome dream actions in a dream. Yeah. But this bodhisattva can do that. Yeah, that's how powerful the ethical conduct is. So that would be nice, wouldn't it? Yeah, you would never wake up in the morning going, ugh, look what I dreamt. Yeah?
So they can control their dreams?
Yeah, yeah. I think they must have some ability to control their dreams. Okay. So that would be a nice quality, wouldn't it? And then, then the fourth one is the mode of taking fruitional rebirth on the second ground. So having attained rebirth as a universal monarch, So the previous one, you know, the Lord of the world, was a universal monarch of just this world. Here in the second ground, it's a universal monarch who controls the four continents. Remember when we do the mandala offering, you have the four continents? Okay. So because of that, one furthers the welfare of sentient beings. So, you know, when you have, what the point is here, when you're able to take rebirth in a position of power in the world, then you have much more influence over sentient beings and can do so much more good and benefit them in so many ways. Similarly, if you don't have much virtue and you have a position of power, you can harm sentient beings in so much more. Yeah? Okay. Then Nagarjuna's precious garland says, the second is called the stainless because all 10 virtuous actions of body, speech, and mind are stainless and the bodhisattva naturally abides in them. Okay. So now I have a question for you. How would realizing emptiness improve your ethical conduct? How does that work? Yeah, this bodhisattva, due to seeing things as empty, they have a special kind of ethical conduct that they naturally abide in. How does that realization of emptiness improve their ethical conduct? Yeah.
I would say because you don't spend all day going, I, me, mine. And so you don't go after all these things that we always desire and get ourselves into trouble with, or have so much reactivity to things because we just see through it all with a very clear, wise mind.
Yeah. Okay, so since that bodhisattva realizes the emptiness of true existence, then when the thought I arises or mine arises, they don't grasp onto it. So then they don't generate, you know, attachment to things, trying to please that eye, aversion to things that are going to hurt that eye. And by not abandoning those afflictions, then they don't create so much negative karma. Yeah, but not even generating those afflictions.
Yeah, you said not abandoning.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, not following those afflictions. Yeah.
I think as I'm sitting here struggling with it a little bit, this is the importance of Lama Tsongkhapa's point that in lack of inherent existence and dependent arising come to the same point.
Right.
Because if you don't have the understanding of dependent arising, this emptiness can just be like, what difference does it make?
Right.
Even if I forget I'm in mind, what difference does it make?
Yeah. So if you don't have the full realization of emptiness, in other words, seeing that emptiness and dependent arising come to the same point, then you're going to fall to one extreme or the other. And you could mistake emptiness for total non-existence and think, well, nothing matters, so ethical conduct isn't important. Yeah, I don't need to keep precepts, there's no good, there's no bad. I'm at a high level, I'm beyond ethical conduct, all this kind of stuff we hear people say. Yeah. Whereas actually, if you have a correct understanding of emptiness, that means you've really understood dependent arising well, which means you see that very well, that harmful intentions create, you know, are harmful karma and lead to suffering. And that good actions and intentions lead to happiness. You see that dependent arising, yeah, between actions and it's their result. So you really treasure it, and your ethical conduct becomes really good. Yeah, that's how it should be if you have a correct understanding. Yeah. So, like you said, that's why Jay Rinpoche really emphasizes, you know, that the full understanding of emptiness goes full circle back to understanding dependent arising on a much subtler level. Okay, so you use dependent arising as a reason to prove emptiness, but after you realize emptiness, you circle around and understand dependent arising at a deeper level. Yeah.
The could also see sentient beings as also being empty of any inherent existence. Instead of seeing them as permanent absolute, is when you get harmed or there's some sort of harm coming your way, you don't react to that and then have afflictions rise in your mind because you see them as being, you know, not permanent, not existent.
Okay, so when you're harmed, you don't create enemies because you don't see inherently existent enemies. And you don't see your own suffering as inherently existent either. Yeah? That would be nice, wouldn't it? Okay. Then Nagarjuna continues, through the maturation of these qualities, the perfection of ethical conduct becomes supreme. The bodhisattva becomes a universal monarch helping beings, master of the glorious four continents and of the precious, the seven precious substances. Okay, so the seven precious substances, when they talk about the universal monarch of, you know, the whole world system, the four continents, they talk about seven precious substances and then seven close precious substances. So the seven precious substances, you'll recognize these. Tell me where they're from. A wheel, wish-granting gem, queen, minister, elephant, horse, and householder. They're from the mandala offering, same ones in the mandala offering. Okay? And then the close substances are a sword, a naga skin, bedding, a park, a house, shoes, and clothing. Okay, so this kind of, you know, Chakravarti king has these special, you know, possessions like this. The thing is, we talk about these special possessions like, you know, they're the possessions of a Chakravarti king, but actually, you know, so, and somebody can get born as a Chakravarti king also because of karma. But here, this whole thing is symbolic of the qualities of the bodhisattva. So when they talk about these seven, they're actually analogous to the seven enlightenment factors or the seven awakening factors. When we talk about the 37 harmonies or the 37 wings to awakening, then one of the subsets is the seven awakening factors. And so these sets of seven all correspond with those. So those seven are correct mindfulness, correct discrimination of phenomena, correct effort, correct rapture. So it's kind of a kind of joy you experience in meditation. Correct pliancy, correct concentration, and correct equanimity. Okay, so, you know, these things are all analogous. They're reminding you that, you know, the bodhisattva doesn't, you know, hang on to a naga skin and say, oh, my precious naga skin, you know, but it's symbolizing the internal qualities of that bodhisattva.
Okay.
It's the skin of a naga.
Yes. What's the naga meaning?
I have no idea. Okay, so there's the explanation follows here, Nagarjuna. There is reason for calling this ground the stainless because, for example, just as when one has wiped away the stains on one's face is free from stains, so this bodhisattva has abandoned the stains of faulty ethics, even in mere dreams, due to which it is called the stainless. Okay? So just as when we clean our face, and our face is stainless, this bodhisattva has cleaned their ethical conduct in waking states and in dreams. So they're called the stainless. That's the name of this, the second bhumi. Okay? And then the ornament of Mahayana Sutra says, because of being free from the stains of exertion at faulty ethics, that faulty ethical conduct, it is asserted as the ground of the stainless. So you don't waste your time with non-virtuous actions. Moreover, Nagarjuna's praise of the element of qualities says, as one who has various stains of desire and so forth is always stained, Whoever is without stain is called the stainless. Okay? So this bodhisattva's stains of desire and so forth are really diminishing. Yeah, they haven't eliminated them yet, but they're really diminishing. But they're still called the stainless because their ethical conduct is very pure. Okay, now we're on coming to the third ground.
Then these bodhisattvas, these king monarchs, are born and they are in this world. Do they remember that they had this motivation to be born as a monarch?
As a monarch. Okay, so these, once you get to the first ground bodhisattva, you can control your rebirths.
Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So they can control that they're reborn as this kind of monarch, and they also can make many, many kinds of emanations.
So they have to be aware of it when they are born, then they know.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I think they must be, aware of it. I don't think they, get up from their crib and say, "Oh, I'm a second ground bodhisattva." Yeah. Yeah, did you?
Yeah, the question is, even though they have not eliminated the roots of the afflictions, could it be said that being able to apply an antidote in our gross way and having a little effect is a little bit like that?
Yeah, right. Yes, even though we haven't abandoned our afflictions. When we apply an antidote, we're receiving a temporary kind of cessation of that affliction. Mm-hmm. So that lets us know that the afflictions are not permanent, they're not the nature of the mind, they can be counteracted. Okay? And then it lets us know that, when we get to those higher stages, then we can start eliminating first the grade of the grade, then the middling of the grade, and so on, these different layers of afflictions.
But they're still not acting out of them, and I'm kind of following the Venerable Sompton's question, they're still not acting out of them way before they're actually
eliminated. Yeah.
And that's what I was kind of drawing a line to. It's like, oh, maybe it's the very beginning of our antidote, so
yeah.
Leads to that.
Yeah, yeah. Right. Okay. So the third ground, the explanation of the third ground, the luminous, has four parts. So it's the same four parts. So the first one, the mode of achieving qualities on the third ground. So on this ground, one attains the 12 sets of qualities explained before 100,000-fold. Okay, so you've now been bumped up. First time you got bumped up 10 times, now you're bumped up 100 times. Okay? Then the second one is the mode of achieving majesty of power on the third ground. So here it's quite similar. Here one amasses at the time of subsequent attainment of the collection of merit for the sake of abandoning the small of the great afflictive obstructions to be abandoned by a path of meditation. Okay, so you're on the second ground, you see that. Then seeing the signs of being able to abandon those, one sets in meditative equipoise on emptiness. Okay, thereby one's meditative consciousness becomes an actual antidote to the small of the great afflictive obscurations to be abandoned by a path of meditation, and one is able to move to the fourth ground. Okay, so just like before. And then the mode of surpassing practice of a far-reaching practice. On this ground, one attains a greatly surpassing practice of far-reaching patience or fortitude, destroying all chances of anger, whether awake or dreaming. Mm. Who wants to attain that ability? Yeah? You don't get angry when you're awake, and you don't even get angry in your dreams. So somebody could say whatever they want, they can do whatever they want, they can call you whatever names, they can disagree with your ideas, they can trample your reputation, and you're completely okay. Wouldn't that be nice? Okay, so we get there by practicing Chapter 6 of Shantideva.
Number two count and screen.
Yeah. But, you know, the more you practice it, the more you can see the effect in your own life. I mean, are you as angry now as you were before you started practicing the Dharma? Mm-hmm. No, you can see that you're not nearly as angry. And the people who are around you can see that you're much better off. Yeah. Okay, then the fourth one, the mode of taking fruitional rebirth on the third ground. So having taken rebirth as Shakra, the Lord of the Gods. So Shakra is the Lord, I think he's of the god realm of the 33. Yeah, so it's one of the desire realm gods. It's the first one. Yeah, so he's the Lord. As Shakra, often, you know, when the Buddha was alive, he would come and talk to the Buddha and request the Buddha to teach, and he was a good guy. So you can take rebirth as Shakra, the Lord of the Gods. One furthers the welfare for the sake of sentient beings. So, you know, having that kind of... I mean, look at what Shakra did. He was the one who together with Brahma and others, asked the Buddha to teach. Yeah, so look at that way of benefiting sentient beings by asking the Buddha to teach. Thank goodness he did. Yeah. Okay, then Nagarjuna's precious garland says, because he has verses about all these different bhumis, the third ground is called the luminous because the pacifying light of wisdom arises. The concentrations of super knowledges are generated while desire and hatred are extinguished completely. Okay, let's look at that first verse. Okay, so the third ground is called the luminous because of the pacifying light of wisdom. Yeah, so there's a certain kind of luminous light from having wisdom. So it's called the luminous. And the concentrations of the super knowledges are generated. Okay, so the super knowledges are five kinds of special powers that you gain by having really cultivating the higher training and concentration. Okay, so the five pure super knowledges. And worldly beings can attain these by when they get to the fourth jhana, the fourth form realm, you know, then they can start attaining these. So there's five of them. The first one is called supernormal powers. So that's the ability to pass through walls, walk on water, fly in the sky, make your body into many bodies, and make from many bodies into back to one body. Okay, so those kind of physical supernormal powers. The second one is the divine ear, so you can hear things that are being spoken in other parts of the universe. So that, you know, if you're a bodhisattva, it's a very good, you know, these powers can be very useful because you can use them to benefit sentient beings. Yeah, if you need to get somewhere quickly, you can fly there. Yeah, if you need to check up on what's happening with your disciples, you can hear what they're saying from a long distance and know what you need to teach them, to correct them or to encourage them or whatever. Okay, then the third one is called understanding others' minds. And so you know you're able at that point to understand a mind that's affected by attachment and from a mind that's not affected by attachment, one affected by anger, from one not affected by anger. What is a liberated mind? What is a not liberated mind? So you can see what's in others' minds and the levels of their minds. The fourth one is recollection of previous lives, so your own previous lives. Fifth one is called the divine eye, so here you can see things far away that are going on in other places of the universe. Okay, this bodhisattva also attains the four pure jhanas and the formless absorptions. as well as the four immeasurables. Okay, so the four immeasurables, the four Brahma Viharas, are often spoken of in terms of you use them as objects of meditation when developing shamatha and attaining the jhanas and so forth. So you're able at this point, because you have this special higher training in concentration, you gain these. Okay? Okay, so then the last line. Okay, so let's finish talking about these concentrations. Okay, so this this bodhisattva on the third bhumi has these great powers of concentration. Okay, they were actually attained on the first bhumi, but here the powers of concentration are even deeper, and they're far superior. So that's why it's emphasized that they've attained them here on this bhumi. And also, this bodhisattva is not born by the power of these meditative absorptions. So even though they've attained, for example, the fourth jhana, usually a normal person, a regular person who's attained the fourth jhana, then in the next life they're born in the fourth jhana. Or somebody who's attained the formless absorption on infinite consciousness is born in that realm in the next breath. But bodhisattvas aren't, because they have renunciation, because they have wisdom, because they have bodhicitta. They're not interested in those rebirths, so they aren't born there by the power of those meditative absorptions. Okay? So instead, these bodhisattvas are born by the power of their prayer. So that's what it meant when I said that they can, starting at the first bhumi, they can control their rebirth. So by the power of their prayer, their aspiration, their determination where they want to be reborn, then they can be reborn in that kind of, with that kind of body, in order to benefit sentient beings. Okay. And then the last line of this quotation said, while desire and hatred are extinguished completely, but the same question comes up here, wait a minute, there on the third bhumi, desire and hatred are not, you know, extinguished completely until the first part of the eighth bhumi. So what's the story here? So again, here it's talking about the manifest forms of desire and hatred are eliminated. And these again are the coarse forms of those afflictions, the ones supported by grasping, self-sufficient, substantially existent person. Okay? But the ones that depend on grasping at true existence haven't been fully eliminated. But let's just finish this section here. Through the maturation of these qualities, the bodhisattva surpassingly practices the deeds of patience or fortitude, and putting an end to desire completely, becomes a great wise king of the gods. Okay? So when it says putting an end to desire completely, it means that this bodhisattva is very skilled in the ability to overcome the lustful desires of worldly sentient beings. Oh. Yeah, so very skillful. I mean, not only overcoming their own desires, but helping others overcome their desires. So there is a reason for calling this ground the luminous, because like a fire burning a collection of firewood, the light of the exalted wisdom, which destroys dualistic appearances, arises in meditative equipoise, whereby in subsequent attainment there dawns the appearance which is like the color of clouds at the time of sunrise and sunset. So that's why it's called the luminous, okay? Because in meditative equipoise, that wisdom is burning the dualistic appearances. So it's like a fire. So then, again, I think metaphorically, in post-meditation time, yeah, there dawns the appearance which is like the color of clouds at sunrise and sunset. So luminous clouds. But I think what this is referring to is that this bodhisattva is even more capable before of seeing things as like illusions in the subsequent attainment time when they come out of their meditative equipoise. Maitreya's ornament for the Mahayana Sutras says, because of causing the great illumination of doctrine, it is the luminous. So it sounds like he also, this bodhisattva, also illuminates the doctrine by the way they teach to other sentient beings. And Nagarjuna's praise of the element of qualities says, having stopped well the net of afflictions, the very clear stainless wisdom clears away immeasurable darkness, whereby it is called the luminous. Okay? So the wisdom clears away darkness, you know, both in meditative equipoise, and then it has that effect after meditative equipoise, where you can even more than before see things as like illusions. Okay? So, we have finished the third ground. Yes?
This thing about seeing the signs so that you have an idea that you might be approaching the next ground, I can't even imagine what... Is there anything about what he means seeing the sounds or how you know you're approaching, so that now's the time to sit down and...
Well, no, when it says seeing the signs of approaching, the way I understand it, is that, you know, you've kept meditating on emptiness all through this ground. Mm-hmm. But at a certain point in your meditative on emptiness, you can feel that it's becoming much stronger. Mm-hmm. You know, that you're just, you're, the force of your wisdom is becoming stronger. You know, in the same way that right now, you can see sometimes, you get a feeling like, oh, I can... You know, I wasn't able to, like, break through this problem before, but now I can. Mm-hmm. So I think they must have that kind of feeling, like, oh, my, you know, my meditation on emptiness is getting stronger. I'm going to be able to break through this next layer and eliminate this next layer of afflictions. So then they go into the uninterrupted path, which is eliminating them, and then from there into the liberated path, which is the having eliminated them. Okay? So they, you know, they must have some kind of internal feeling, oh, now I can do it. Hmm? Yeah?
And you mentioned before immeasurables, I couldn't get it. They use it as an object, and how do they?
Yeah. Sometimes when they're describing the teachings on how to develop serenity, mm-hmm. the four immeasurables mm-hmm. can be used as your object mm-hmm. of meditation. Mm-hmm. So here, because this particular bodhisattva has a special practice of the higher training of concentration, then they have the four immeasurables really well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay? Okay, good. Then we'll continue with the fourth ground next week. Yeah. So really think about this. It's quite inspiring, you know, when you think about, oh, there's beings who have these qualities and I can attain them too. And one day I will attain them.
Overwhelmingly, no, I can't do it.
Mm-hmm.
It's just explained so beautifully.
Yeah.
And for me, I feel like I'm getting a heart connection to them.
Right.
You know, they've been my mother in previous lives, and now they're farther along in the path, and they care about all of us. I think I'm getting more of a connection to having a relationship to them.
With these bodhisattvas, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it really increases your Sangha refuge to meditate on these teachings, because now you really know the qualities of the bodhisattvas. So when you take refuge in them, you know what you're taking refuge in.
May the spiritual teachers who lead me on the sacred path, and all spiritual friends who practice it, have long life. May crucify completely all outer and inner hindrances. Grant such inspiration, I pray. May the lives of the venerable spiritual mentors be stable, and their virtuous actions spread in the 10 directions. May the light of Lobsang's teachings dispelling the darkness of the beings in the three worlds always increase. Guru Rana Mandala Kanyatayami. Due to this merit, may we soon attain the awakened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind not yet born arise and grow. May the born have no decline, but increase forevermore. In the snowy mountain pure land, you're the source of good and happiness. Powerful Tenzin Gyatso Chenresi, may you stay until samsara ends. May the deeds of explaining and practicing the Dharma done by groups supporting the teachings and their upholders who spread the view of dependent arising and nonviolent actions in the 10 directions, and especially at Shravasti Abbey in the West Florida.